And let me introduce Alan Gisbers. Alan Gisbers is the president of ISCAST. He's also the head of addiction medicine at the Royal Melbourne Hospital. And there are many other credentials that I could also tell you about, but I won't. And he's here to talk about the brain. Is the brain just a lump of flesh, or is it something more? Alan, please come forward. Sorry I've taken so much of your time. Please welcome Alan.
Thanks very much, Chris. Chris could have gone on and not just talked about the strategy of ISCAST in schools, but also talked about the strategy of ISCAST in the undergraduate world, in the academic world, and in the world of the churches and places like that. So we've got a huge job ahead of us if we're going to try and address this science-religion interface sensibly, thoughtfully, and in a godly way. That's what I'm going to talk about tonight. Thank you for coming. I hope you'll find it interesting. I'm always a bit afraid when I start a talk like this because there's bound to be a computer nerd in here somewhere who's done a lot more reading than I have. But that's all right. We're in a conversation. I'm much more of an applied neuroscientist. My laboratory is the bedside and my clinical consulting suite, where I see people every day who have an addiction problem. And therefore that this mind-brain issue is lurking in the background. Now, those of you who are on the internet will see that there's already a video publication of this lecture that I gave in South Australia. Now, South Australia are more gourmands, and the title was, "Is the Brain Just a Computer Made of Meat?" But that was too cannibalistic for the New South Wales audience, and so we cast around to try and work out what would be more acceptable. And it's actually quite nice to think about the idea, is the brain a computer made of flesh? Because that's such a rich word, isn't it? And if in my lecture I haven't quite given you the full implications of what it might be, you might say, well, what else do you know about the flesh? Because, of course, in the addiction area, we're dealing with the flesh the whole time in that technical sense. I want you to notice the word just, and I will talk a lot about reductionism during my talk because I think that's important. What does neuroscience say about who I am? Who am I is one of the really key questions. That's a very curly one that's worth spending a bit of time unpacking. Now, I think I've got something in my pocket that should do the clicking, shouldn't it, somewhere? That's not it. Unless it's inside. No. What did I do with it? Oh, here it is, right here. I'm right now. So, the overview of the lecture. Is the brain a computer? And of course I'm going to give you the answer yes and no, and we'll try and make that a little bit more substantial. I want to talk about neuroscience, particularly in terms of reductionism and emergence. Don't worry, these are technical terms, but I will unpack them, but I want you to be familiar with these terms by the end of the lecture. I'm going to talk about qualia and intentionality. Again, you'll need to be patient with that, but they do mean something. I want to talk about affective neuronal Darwinism. Again, it's a new idea, but I think it's a very effective one, and it's certainly helped us in the psychiatric hospital in which I work as being a way of understanding what's going on with human beings. Then I want to ask the question of who am I and how different is that from what is human, bring some sort of synthesis to bear on those two questions, and finally bring some Christian comments to this synthesis. So you ready to go for the ride? Let's see how we go. It's very attractive to think of the mind as being the computer software, the brain as being the hardware. That energy to the brain occurs through glucose transported from the rest of the body to nerve cells in the bloodstream. And to see that the mind or the brain has perceptive inputs integrating what is out there with what is already known. And perception is more than just the five senses. It's not the classical five senses of Aristotle, but there's proprioception, there's a sense of pain, there's a sense of temperature, and all these other senses as well. And then there's motor outputs in terms of actions, words, which are oral and written. And so at first sight, there may be an analogy between computer, between the mind being software and the brain hardware. But there are technical issues. And if you are a computer nerd, I would suggest that this website might be helpful. There are about 12 points. I didn't put all of them up because I think that that's just too laborious. I don't want to give a broad overview. But by and large, the brain is an analog, whereas the computer is digital. The brain tends to work in terms of networks rather than in terms of algorithms. Memory sites and processing sites seem to be different in the computer than they are in the brain. Memory storage is different in the brain from what it is in the computer. Synapses are different from electric gates, and I'll introduce to you what synapses are. And the human brain, interestingly, is capable of intuitive leaps. And it's this incredible creativity, which I think algorithms and painstaking working through that computer nerds want to do, just doesn't apply to the brain. But I want to talk about much bigger issues, which is the issue of self-awareness. Now, how many of you have heard of Alan Turing? Alan Turing, most of you have, yeah? The Turing test, are you familiar with the Turing test? What is the Turing test? I won't ask somebody to stand up and give me an answer, but I'll just say, look, the Turing test is where the computer convinces you that it is human. I am not sure how good a computer is at telling you that it is human, because by and large the output tends to be logical and rational and doesn't have the emotional modulation which is so much part and parcel of human interactions. And I'm going to make a lot of this over the course of the lecture, because I think that it's the relation of the emotions to our rational selves that makes a key difference between human beings and their way of approaching things compared to a computer or a machine or something like that. Now, it was John Searle who talked about the Chinese room. Are you familiar with the Chinese room at all? By and large, not. I can speak freely in that case. Let's see if I can get it right. Imagine that there's a room in which you put in Chinese words and out the other side come English words. Now, John Searle says, I'm going to put myself into that room, and by looking up dictionaries and things like that, I can move the Chinese word into putting out an English word. But I don't understand Chinese myself at all. There is a whole internal world which I know that I don't understand what's going on. So what John Searle is showing how essential his internal world is into what's going on. Now, of course, it's not just a case of translating word for word. What you've got to do is you've got to try and translate sentences. And those of you who've used Google Translators know how much fun you can have in a situation like that, don't you? I mean, they translated "the spirit is willing and the flesh is weak" into Russian, and it came back as "the vodka's terrific, but the meat is rotten." Okay? Or "out of sight, out of mind" comes back blind and stupid. So you can see how subtle changes in syntax can make a considerable difference. Now, sometimes there may be computers which will do that, but if you go and ask yourself, if I'm in that room, would I understand? Now, of course, the problem is, the only way I have access to the internal world, which is your internal world, is what you tell me. Now, I don't know if those who did psychology in the 60s will know that we were so keen to be so objective and scientific that in fact we said, oh, the internal world doesn't matter. Right? These were the behaviourists' days. We were going to be objective and scientific. I'm not interested in your internal world. And then they said, no, what about... So they were the behaviourists. No, what about the cognitive behaviourists? Well, people who actually think. And how do I have access to the thinking? By talking to you. And then we said, that's the second way. The first way was the behaviourists, the second way was the cognitive behaviourists. The third wave
was the mindfulness type people, because they started to recognise that not only do we think what we feel as well, we have an emotional area to us also, and a reflective area, and there's a lot more to us than just our thinking. And we're slowly moving away from what Charles Taylor describes as detached rationalism, detached reason. Although it seems to still exist in some theological culture. I won't go there. All right. Detached reason is not what human beings do. Now, if I'm to have access to your internal world, I have to ask you. And you will tell me, but you will tell me through your interpretative grid. And then I will interpret what you say through my interpretative grid. So there are two levels of interpretation that go on for me to have access to your internal world. Where am I? I'm talking about the inside versus the outside, the meanness of me. And what I'm getting to is your own internal world. And this is the concept of qualia, which is the redness of red, the musicality of music, the richness of what we perceive for ourselves. It is our rich internal world that we have, which David Chalmers uses the term qualia, which I think is quite a nice word. John Searle uses the term intentionality, meaning not just intending, but really feeling and knowing from within. And all of us have these qualities. Now, it's interesting. I was at the Butterfly Sanctuary in Port Douglas the other day, Kuranda. The butterfly sees in a certain way and perceives things. And I suddenly thought, well, what does the butterfly perceive? And does the butterfly perceive in the way that I perceive? And what sort of neural processes does the butterfly have? And is there anybody who does any butterfly psychology to try and work out what the internal world of the butterfly... What a fascinating set of questions. We have no idea how the mind and the brain are related. And David Chalmers talks about this as being the hard mind-brain problem. How does the mind interact with the brain? And that's something of what we want to explore today. By the way, that's HAL, Space Odyssey 2000. I think that's all too old for some of you youngins here. You wouldn't know what I'm talking about at that point. But this was a computer who tried to take over the spaceship and they had to close me down. And he got upset about that. Let's talk about basic neuroscience. Nerve cells among glial cells is where we go right down to the basics. We are made of nerve cells, and nerve impulses travel at 0.1 volt at 1 by 2 times 10 to the minus 3 seconds, or at 48 kilometres an hour, in which an action potential here moves along the nerve from the nerve cell out to the axon and down to the other end. And this is how the action potential goes, with sodium being inside the cell, and therefore the nerve is positive on the outside, negative on the inside, and then there's a change in the electrolyte so that it goes the opposite way, and so an electrical impulse goes along. So basically we think through electricity, if you like. Now, these action potentials, they move along and the flow of information is in an FM type fashion up here, and it starts from the dendrites. Where did I go? Pressed the button too much. The dendrites here receive messages which are then passed on to the nucleus, and then from the nucleus along the axon down to the synapse, which is that connection in there, and that's where all the interesting stuff occurs. And it was Sir John Eccles from Canberra, Australian National University, who won the Nobel Prize by describing the synapse, and we'll do that in the next little bit. So that a message passes from one nerve cell to the other nerve cell via the synapse here. Now, if you think that that's pretty interesting, this is what an actual neural network looks like, and your brain is composed of a network as complicated as those two there. Now, when you think about the network being as complicated as that, this is Ramon Y Cajal, who was the histologist who first showed just how complicated these things are. And that's just a sample of what goes on inside the brain. And to think that those sort of messages passing backwards and forwards like that, that somehow by changing the chemical soup of the brain can change the way you feel if you're depressed, it's a rather a staggering thought, really, isn't it? It's pretty complicated. So the synapse is where most of the messages are modulated, whereby we have certain vesicles with neurotransmitters inside them, and then when a nerve impulse comes along the axon, the vesicle passes onto the end plate of the neuron, releases the vesicle into the synaptic cleft, and there the neurotransmitter receptors are ready to receive that particular neural message and pass on the message to the next neuron. And all the fun of neuromodulation occurs either in binding the vesicles so that they don't release the messages, or in changing the receptors so that the vesicles' message is either sustained or blocked. And that's where it's all happening. Oh, that's the theory. So that neurotransmitters are small chemicals who pass signals from one neuron to the next via the synapses. And you've got a whole range of them, some of whom you know, the dopamine, the noradrenaline, the acetylcholine, serotonin, GABA, glutamate, endorphins, and anandamides. Now, is there somebody from India here? Anyone from India? Do you know anandamides? Do you know Sanskrit, sir?
I don't know much.
No much, don't much. When you were, I had the same problem. My Tamil's getting very bad. Anandamides is from the Latin, from Sanskrit, which is an ancient Indian language, and the Sanskrit means bliss. It's actually the natural cannabinoids that we have circulating in our brain. And I love saying this, we're built for bliss, we're built for pleasure. Wow, you've got cannabis circulating in the brain to make you feel good. What's it there for? Why have we got this? Why do we need to be made to feel good? Well, let's see if we can explore that for a bit. And it's the action of these neurotransmitters that can be altered by ingested chemicals like antidepressants, antipsychotics, analgesics, addictive agents, and all that sort of stuff. Wow. Well, but I think it's really quite amazing to think that we change the chemical soup within which the brain is bathed, and we hope that we can make some sort of meaningful result out of that. But somehow we seem to. I want to pause at this point, because what often happens is what's called foundationalism. And the tacit philosophical assumptions here is that once the basics are clarified, the superstructure automatically and logically will follow. Or reductionism, the idea that once you've reduced the problem down to its component parts, you've solved the problem. Because once you know the components, everything else automatically follows. For instance, now that we've clarified synaptic transmission, we understand depression. Now that we've sequenced the human genome, we understand human beings. Do you see how, what I'm trying to say is that reductionism is a useful tool to analyse a problem by reducing it to its component parts. And studying the components with an isolating system can be very useful. I'm not saying it's not. But it's insufficient because it's susceptible to what's called nothing buttery. That is, humans are nothing but a series of biochemical reactions. Addiction is nothing but a chemical aberration of the brain, or humans are nothing but a computer made of... Oh, sorry, Peter, it says made of meat, I should have said made of flesh. Anyway, but you see what it can be? And it's this reductionism that's, I think, one of my major theses, that reductionism is insufficient of itself. And I will hopefully give you intellectual tools which will enable you to refute that particular position. This is challenged at least by concept of top-down causation. That is, that the whole influenced the part. That is, that the whole system can change individual components. And I'll give you an example of this as a way forward out of this reductionistic myth that we often find ourselves in. Eric Kandel was a psychiatrist who went into neuroscience, and his biography is one of the most exciting books I've read in a long time. It's called In Search of Memory, The Emergence of a New Science of Mind. It was published in 2006, as you see there. Now, what he shows is that what he studied was the aplysius snail. And when you stick the aplysius snail in a certain environment and give it certain stimuli, single pulses with serotonin, what you can do is you can increase the release of serotonin across the synapse. But if he gave five pulses of serotonin, surprise, surprise, not only was there an increase in the glutamate neurotransmitter, but there was a growth of axons. Now, this is absolutely amazing, and I will show you why. What he then did, I mean, Eric had the great skill of identifying bright young men and drawing them into his research projects, and some of these were biochemists who were interested in gene expression and that sort of stuff. So they had appropriate experiments showing that the release of serotonin by another nerve onto this particular nerve actually sent messages up to the nucleus and switched on the nerve of the nucleus of the neuron. And that nerve then caused the axon to grow. Now that is revolutionary, because what that means is that gene expression isn't constant there, fixed at all, but it is subject to external stimuli. So what that means is that nature changes gene expression and changes neural function. No wonder he got the Nobel Prize. So these are the five principles that he put forward as a result of that particular basic work. All mental processes derive from operations of the brain. Genes determine neural functioning. Social and developmental factors contribute importantly to the variance in mental illness. These factors express themselves in altered gene expression of the neuron. So that nurture is ultimately expressed as nature. So it's no longer the case that heredity or environment, but the environment changes the inherited genes that you have so that the gene now expresses itself differently. Wow. Altered gene expression induced by learning gives rise to changed patterns of neural connections, which give rise to different forms of thinking and behaviour. Psychotherapy produces changes in long-term behaviour by learning, which produces changes in gene expression, and hence changes in neural interconnection. You see, what's happening at the moment is I'm talking to you, and if I say something sufficiently often, hopefully your neural genes will be switched on and you will be producing more axons and it'll actually stay in your brain for a little longer than just tonight. I have hopes. Maybe I'm not stimulating you enough. It'll just increase your glutamate transmission for a little while and it'll then disappear. But you see how we've got this mechanism now by which the environment changes gene expression, which therefore changes neural expression. I'm gobsmacked by that. I don't know about you. I think I can see some nods here. Excellent. Note the interaction of the environment and genetic action, hence to generate neural activity. So here is one mechanism for top-down influence. The environment influences the whole, and the question then arises, can the organism influence itself? Can I change my neural expression by the way I talk to myself? Maybe. Maybe my careful reflection, certainly reflection which goes right back before the New Testament to the Old Testament, to the Psalms, bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless his holy name, the way I talk to myself, may that change the way I see the world. Who knows? Possibly. Now I'm going to move from having talked about sort of fairly basic neuroscience to now talking about the brain as a whole, because I think there's a lot more to the brain than just what I've described. What I've just described is neurons and neural synapses and how neural synapses can change. Now, The brain is composed of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lobes, but not two fissures, but many fissures. And you can sort of divide the brain up into these particular parts overall. And if you look at the medial side of the brain, as you cut your brain right through and then look at the one side of it, you'll see that there's this thing called a corpus callosum, which connects the left brain to the right brain. And then there are even more neuroanatomical areas which exist. And it's about 1.8 kilograms of flesh, which is responsible for our thinking and feeling and behaviour. Although if you look at Antonio Damasio's writing, he says, we don't just think of the brain in isolation, but the brain is embodied, and it's the peripheral nerves and the messages from your arms and your hands and your feet and the way you orientate yourself in space. That's the way you see your brain. Now, it was Broca who first decided that he was talking to somebody with what's called Broca's aphasia. And when the person died, he studied the brain at autopsy and found that there was a lesion in the brain. Broca's aphasia is a difficulty of language whereby a person is no longer fluent in their speaking. In fact, they've got a non-fluent dysphasia, as it's sometimes called, or aphasia. And these were the patients we used to have, let's say fun, that sounds disrespectful. I don't mean it disrespectfully, but when I was teaching medical students and a person with aphasia came in, we'd ask her to name things. What's that? That's a, and she couldn't name it. If she had a naming problem and then a problem of expression. And sometimes these dear little old ladies, they would say, this is a bugger. Which was sort of sad, but, they had difficulty in expression. And then there was a character called Wernicke who came along, and he studied people who had difficulty understanding, the so-called receptive dysphasia in some circles. And there was a part in the back part of the dominant hemisphere of the brain which is affected by that. So that then led to the idea that certain parts of the brain do certain things, the sort of idea of localization. So while the Penfield was a neurosurgeon in Canada who would not anaesthetise his patient, have them under local anaesthetic, and while under anaesthesia he would stimulate certain parts of the sensory cortex and say, well, what do you feel here? Tell me what you're feeling. And so we would get this cartoon as to what a person feels in the sensory part of both sides of our brain. Feeling on the opposite sides, because it crosses across halfway down. And you can see here how much the face and how much the lips on the face are so much more represented than other areas of the person, for instance, say the upper arm or something like that, and the testes a very small part. And then he'd stimulate the motor part of the brain, and he'd twiggle the toe, or he'd twiggle an ankle, or he'd twiggle a knee, or the gluteal muscles here of the body, and you see how big the hand is in its representation, and again how much of the face and vocalisation is being expressed in the brain here. Which then led to the idea that the brain, if you can localise the brain, the area of the brain, then that explains what's going on. And those of you who've done any reading of it, then you'll hear that people, if you stimulate the temporal part of the brain, that's the God area, and people have a religious experience. Therefore, a religious experience is nothing but a stimulation of the brain. Right? Like when you're expressing love to your partner, it's nothing but a series of chemical reactions to the brains. Of course, clearly that's not so. Now, we now know, because of functional MRI studies and those sort of things in the last 10 years or so, 15 years or so, that in fact there is mass action as well as specific localised areas, and that the cerebellum is involved in memory, mood, language and attention, and that so-called solid areas, which didn't seem to do anything in this sort of passive stimulation sort of way, may in fact light up as you actually do things actively in terms of your cogitation and your feelings and your emotions and all of those sort of things. So what I've done is I've talked about the large parts of the brain as well as the very small parts, but what about the bits in between? How do we move from the overall phenomena or the higher functions of perception, decision, emotion, reasoning, drive, qualia and intentionality, you now know what those words are, and our sense of self to basic brain functions? And what I thought I'd do is just introduce you a little bit to the circuits of addiction, which serve to colour an experience with emotion and direct the individual responses to rewarding stimuli, including food, sex and social interaction, the last of which I think is the most important. We are humans, we are social interactive type people, and the pleasure centre of the brain is about that social interaction. Now, if a person's intact in terms of their pleasure pathways, there are pathways for reward, there are pathways for drive, there are pathways for control, and there are pathways for memory. And if they're integrated, this is the non-addicted brain. And I can go in greater detail, but I won't, for the purposes of this lecture, talk about the addicted brain where reward, drive and memory are autonomous and out of control, particularly by the frontal lobes of the brain. And as we continue to stimulate that particular circuitry, that will get strengthened. And as we try and bring control back, we can rearrange those circuits into a non-addicted system. So what I'm describing here is the intermediate areas between the synapses on the one hand and the very higher centres on the other by talking about neural circuits. And we need to talk at the level of circuits. Now, how can we do this? And what I'm trying to introduce to you here is called the issue of emergent properties. And what I want to do at this stage is to take yourself just a step back a bit and to see the way we create a hierarchy of the sciences and of the way we understand ourselves. We are built of subatomic particles. These form atoms. These atoms form molecules, and the molecules form organelles. Organelles form cells. Cells form tissues, organs and organ systems, nervous system. Eventually we have a person, and we describe that in terms of their experience and their behaviour. Do you see that hierarchy there? But that's not the only hierarchy there is. There is another hierarchy, which is the hierarchy of the person, and I'm sorry, the colouring doesn't seem to be too good, person in a two-person system who live in a family, who live in a community, who live in a subculture or a culture, who live in a society or a nation, who live in a biosphere. And each of these systems can be studied in their own right and can be related either up or down. And what I want to introduce you to now is the concept of emergence and emergent complexity. Emergent complexity directly challenges radical reductionism, which states that addiction is nothing but an aberration of the limbic system and addiction is nothing more than a brain disease. And it does so by arguing that the components act within a wider context and that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. You with me? Yeah? Good. So the principles of emergent complexity is that science becomes increasingly complex, from physics through biology to sociology, and that we can understand the sciences in terms of modular hierarchical structures. And what a person will tend to do is that they are a physicist, they will study the physics of that particular system. But if they're a molecular biologist, they will have a different way of seeing their particular module, their particular hierarchy. And to some extent, they will see that as a black box in which they're not interested in what quarks and gluons and those sort of things might be doing at the subatomic level. Nor are they interested in what the atoms are doing. What they're interested in, how the molecules in three-dimensional space create receptors for their molecular biology. Each higher layer depends on the layer below. We need to have the quarks and gluons in order to have the atoms, in order to have the next layer. It's not that we can do without them. They're not autonomous in that sense. They're dependent on the layer below. But we do not need to know in the layer below in detail to make sense of the science that we're having at the time, whatever that science might be. New phenomena emerge at the next layer, which are not predicated by the layer below. And the terms that are often used are the terms supervenience and emergence. So if you put two hydrogen molecules with an oxygen molecule, you put those two gases together, you get a very different substance, which of course is dihydrogen monoxide, which is water. And if you just have one water molecule, it's quite different from what happens when all these water molecules interact together to form surface tension. And you cannot determine the wetness of water by just studying one molecule. You need a torrent of water to do so. Each layer is relatively unaffected by lower layers. There's a certain autonomy about the layer that you're understudy. And more complex layers can alter the layer below, which is the concept of top-down causation. The whole influences the part. But in summary, emergent complexity then recognises there's hierarchy, recognises there's bottom-up causation, recognises the concept of emergence, whereby at the next layer things can happen quite differently from what they would in the layer below, a certain degree of autonomy about each particular layer, and the concept of top-down causation. Now, that top-down causation will become an increasingly important issue as we talk about the mind-brain problem. You still with me? Okay. In contrast to reductionism, addiction is not just a biochemical reaction in the brain, but a biopsychosocial condition requiring multiple inputs from multiple dimensions. So anybody who thinks there's a drug solution to the drug problem doesn't understand the drug problem. It requires, therefore, a multidisciplinary approach and cannot be just solved by pharmacologists. Higher functions can be regarded as emergent properties, but this just articulates the mind-brain problem. It doesn't solve it. But it gives us some idea what the mind-brain problem is. All right? And if you ask me personally, this is where I'm banging my head at the moment against some of my psychiatric colleagues who seem to think that depression is nothing but serotonin deficiency and that giving you the right drug will treat your depression. I said to one patient recently, "Don't use the word depression, tell me how you're really feeling." And she said, "Betrayed." Now, if she felt betrayed, that becomes a relational issue, not a pharmacological issue. And the solution to the betrayal is far different from just simply giving her a different biochemical soup for the brain. And I think it's a fundamental category error to think there's a pharmacological solution to a relational problem. So the WHO has a very interesting model about drug use in which the disposition to drug use leads to drug use, which leads to a neuroadaptive state with tolerance and withdrawal, reinforcing and aversive consequences, all of which affects the disposition to drug use in terms of approach learning and avoidance learning. So all of that is within the person. Yet there are social and individual antecedents, both distal and immediate, which change the disposition to drug use. Things like licensing laws, social pressure, availability, demographic variables, all of those social things will alter the disposition to drug use. But the susceptible person will use, depending on all that. And then there are individual distal and immediate antecedents, which will determine whether a person uses a drug or doesn't use a drug. So I think this sort of gives a much more comprehensive biopsychosocial approach to the problem of addiction, which is much more than just a brain disease in which you just change your neurochemical transmitters. Let me just pause a little bit because I want to push you just a little further. You ready for the next challenge? Because this, I think, is where it becomes really interesting. I am going to talk about neural Darwinism now, which is that biological complexity is generated in each individual by developmental processes based on a reading of the genetic information stored in the sequence bases in DNA, which creates a highly structured organism out of differentiated cells and influenced by information from the environment. Bit heavy, you understand what we're trying to say? We have only a certain sequence of DNA, and yet somehow, once the DNA is activated, we develop into very diverse human beings. What's going on? The principles of Darwinian natural selection apply when using genetic information in each individual for brain development, hence the term neural Darwinism. What does that mean? Both because the stored information is far too little to control brain development by itself, that is, we only have 45,000 genes, but millions of cells and millions of neurons, in fact billions of them, which if they can be read multiple times and can be read in different combinations, will cause differences to be. So what's going on? Edelman says that there is what's called effective neural selection, which means what's happening here. Nerves develop axons, and they develop all sorts of connections. And as we develop, there are a lot more connections, but that those connections which are used tend to remain, whereas those which are not used tend to die out. So that if you continue to use circuits, they will remain. If the circuits die out, they will wither. And so at certain points, children are poised to learn certain things, and if they use that opportunity at that time, they will develop. Language is one of those examples. And yet, once the opportunity is gone, it's much harder. The initial set of relatively non-specific synaptic connections are refined to produce a precise pattern of connectivity. Neurotransmitters alter gene expression. Now, the effective component is what I want to bring to bear to Edelman's neuronal group selection, which is that a value system is required to decide which should be regarded as positive or good from a survival viewpoint, and this is provided by the primitive emotions which have been characterised by a guy called Panksepp, which is that neurotransmitters start in the reptilian part of the brain, spread to the emotional part of the brain, and then develop to the intellectual part of the brain. So when a baby is born, a baby when it's born has these basic primitive values, not just anxiety or depression, but they have a seeking system, a rage system, a fear system, a lust system, a care system, a panic system, and a play system. And all of these emotions together form a child as it is growing up. And it's how the child develops itself out of these emotions which will determine what sort of a person they will become. So the hypothesis is that the basic emotional system identified by Panksepp, together with inputs from endocrine and immune systems, are necessary and sufficient to provide the value system of neural Darwinism identified by Edelman and Tononi. The primary emotions characterised above become the linchpin in linking neurophysiology to experience in social and physical environments. So that hardwired emotions firing in the limbic system or the pleasure centre of the brain send out connections to the higher centres, and that these circuits that are used remain and strengthen, but those that are not used wither. So emotions expressed in a social environment drive the development of those higher connections. What am I trying to say? I'm sorry, that sounded a little bit highfalutin. Let me just put it through. There's a book by Peter Hobson, who's both a psychiatrist and a psychologist, called Cradle of Thought, or Teach These Souls to Fly, who says that a child, through play and socialisation, learns a sense of themselves, a sense of the other, the rules of interaction, the modes of persuasion, the benefits of being persuaded, how to resolve conflicts and cooperate. They describe how people will develop appropriate boundaries. And the borderline personality disorder mum, who's a person without boundaries, is described as being intrusive and unresponsive.
as a child plays. So a healthy mum, when you see the child play, they will join in the play and allow the child to develop its own way of expressing itself. But if a mother is boundaryless, what she will do is she'll interrupt and she'll become intrusive. And when the child wants something, she doesn't know how to respond. And learning how to relate well to each other within an environment of play is how we develop as healthy human beings. And so this is what I mean by the emotions then shaping who we are and how we are, how we express ourselves. So Peter Hobson, in reply to the questions, "Are humans just computers made of meat?" says this: "Any thinker needs the appropriate kind of body and capacity to feel and act in order to connect with the world that contains the object of thought. It is not just that computers do not have the right kind of relations with things around them. It is also they do not have the right kind of relations with each other. If computers want to think, they had better get a social life." And I would also add to that, computers need to develop an emotional life, because it's out of our emotionality that we develop our rationality and our relationality. And what I'm trying to do is to bring the emotional part of ourselves as part and parcel of who we are. We're not just disengaged reasoners. We are thinking, feeling, passionate and compassionate people. I said that feelingly. And that's one of the major reasons why I think computers will never be like humans, because computers are... Why is it that people who talk about computers and that are all the nerdy type, you know, the type who have no emotional life at all, by and large, and you sort of feel like, hey, give them a shake and say, hey, come on, let's have some fun, will you? Just learn some, another ride, some pleasure. Now we get to the hard mind-brain question, and I'm getting towards the end of what I'm talking about, can you believe? How do mind functions arise out of brain activity? How do we get emotions, thoughts, drives, decisions, intention out of the qualia, and a sense of self out of the brain activity? That's the hard question, and I come to you saying I don't have an answer, except mutter, 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 emergence or supervenience, or maybe it's a higher centre property, but I can't sort of give you any answer beyond that. And I don't accept Polkinghorne's suggestion that it's found in the perturbations of chaos theory or Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. That's too foundationalistic. I think Kandel's suggestion about switching on and off genes may be helpful to some extent, but I think maybe the way we train in play and in relationships might be a way in which we start to determine how we are who we are. Which then leads to the next big question, the huge question, who am I? And I feel embarrassed that I've reached this point in my lecture, because it took me 2 years to get around this book. I'm starting to read it again, it's now making sense, whereas before. And this book is even more heavy than that. What does Taylor himself say about the source of the self? In summary, Taylor says, Charles Taylor, who's a philosopher, political philosopher from McGill University, after reflecting deeply on what it is to understand ourselves and how this has undergone great changes neurophilosophically, says, we are humans who make choices. We make choices for our flourishing. And what is the environment in which we make these choices? And we make these choices in a narrative conversation with others as well. And we'll come back to this narrative story. Siegel, who's a historian from New York, talks about humans being embodied, reflective and relational. Hobson talks about ourselves neurodevelopmentally within an emotional and a relational context. So we are starting to get some sort of feel as to who we are. And I'm very aware that I haven't even mentioned the soul at this point, and I'm going to leave that aside. You can ask me that in question time. But I do want to ask you, what's this? Three full stops and a line.
So?
All right. Somebody... If I said three dots and a dash,
a light starting to switch on, three dots and a dash, or am I so anachronistic here? Have we heard of Morse code? All right, Morse code. So you're going da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Oh, yeah, S-O. No, it's not S-O-S. What is it? Well, I'll let you know what it is. It's the letter V in Morse code. Now, suddenly you'll see this in a new light. All right. Now, for honours, put it to music. Da 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 da. Right, Beethoven's which? Fifth. Which movement? First movement. Which bar? Opening bar. That's right. It's the opening bar of the fifth of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. When was that played particularly? Come on. Those of my vintage were a little bit older. But, It was BBC News Service to Occupied Europe. All right? Da-da-da-da. This is the BBC News Service. All right? This was all propaganda. It was Winston Churchill going around with a cigar going like that. All right? Now, do you see what I've done? I've created a whole story with a whole set of rich associations to what are simply three dots and a dash. And I've suddenly given them a whole lot of meaning, which they didn't have for you earlier. And if this really is impressive, you'll remember this for the rest of your life. Otherwise, it'll just be glutamate passing across a synapse and then being completely lost. But if I sort of jump up and down and say it again, then maybe you'll get a new axonal neural growth. What I'm trying to say is that you will never find meaning just by analysing three dots and a dash. What you need is some sort of interpretation. You need some sort of story in order for that to become more meaningful. It was Paul Ricoeur talking about the self who says this very, very profound comment, which we're still thinking through. Hermeneutics is just means interpretation. Initially it was the interpretation of texts, particularly biblical texts. Then it becomes the interpretation of any story, any narrative, history particularly. Ricoeur then goes on and says everything that we see or do is interpreted by us. Do you remember what I was talking earlier about the access to your inner world? It comes through your interpretive grid and enters my interpretive grid. And so there is nothing in self-understanding that's not mediated by signs, symbols and texts. In the final analysis, self-understanding coincides with the interpretation given to these mediating terms. You understand who you are by interpreting yourself and interpreting your story and reinterpreting your story. I've gone on too long, otherwise I'd talk about something else. But okay, well, I'll leave that alone. What stories shape us? We have our family narrative. We have our cultural narrative. We have our formative stories. And then we have God's story. And all of those stories will then shape the way we understand ourselves and understand the world. How do you interpret that story? My interpretation, number one, is that when the best man who ever lives encounters the most developed religion of the day, that's how he finishes up. When sheer unadulterated goodness confronts the political processes which are part and parcel of the religious systems of the day, he gets crucified. And over his head, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. This is majesty. This is authority. This is power. In the powerlessness of the cross. Tell that to the Christian politicians today, in the first instance. Now, when you look at that particular story of how he finished up this way, You will hear as a subtext to the story, that was his journey, and he invites us to go on that journey with him. Oh. And that then throws the whole question of the meaning of suffering in a completely different and a completely new light. Now, just before he died, he had a supper with his people, with his followers. And he gave bread and he passed around wine and said, "This is my body, this is my blood, this is for you." And there's a whole theology that's been built up about that, in which somehow or other that particular death means that there is forgiveness of sins for you and for me, and a whole new life and a whole new way of living and loving. The Christ has to suffer, and that's the heart of the Christian story. But there's another side of the story, because he wasn't just a man who came and was a perfect man who died, but he was raised on the third day. As I say down here, if only they'd listened to the women, they would have discovered what happened earlier, but being men, they're a bit slower to pick up what's going on. What's happening? It's empty. What's going on? And this particular event means that there's a whole new direction for human beings, because death is now not the end. It is now the gateway to a rich and better and fuller life, which will take place one day when heaven comes back to earth and a new heaven and a new earth are created. So let's review this. Is a computer a brain? Well, yes and no, but I think there's a lot more qualities to the brain than that. Hopefully you've learnt a little bit about reductionism and emergence, about qualia and intentionality, and understood a little bit about effective neural Darwinism. Who am I? I'm embodied or enfleshed, and I'm a chooser of options. And in this story, I develop a sense of who I am, and that story is in the process of developing. The synthesis between the mind and the brain is provisional and incomplete, but as Christians we see ourselves within the story of a believing community, and we invite others to reflect on and join those stories that we tell. Thank you very much.